Welcome to CFO Insights, the leading podcast for finance professionals in disruptive tech, brought to you by the startup CFO community. I'm Guy Hutchinson, and I'm the host of the podcast, as well as being a tech CFO. In this episode, we're going to talk to Joe Knowles, VC and partner at Smedvig, as well as angel investing at Seed. For this conversation, we've picked the topic of making that first finance leadership hire in a venture-backed business. Joe explains how the CFO role is different from others in the C-suite and how the team at Smedvig seeks to persuade founders of the ROI in that hire. He talks through what the investor director looks for in a strategic CFO and how a focus on hiring up, bringing in someone with experience deep into the growth stage, can so often pay off. Introducing our new podcast sponsor, Vertice, founded in the UK by serial entrepreneurs and brothers Eldar and Roy Tuvey. Vertice is a technology company designed to help startups and scale-ups manage their SaaS and cloud spend. To find out how to streamline your renewals, get visibility on your tech stack, and most importantly, save up to 25% on your SaaS and cloud spend, visit vertice.one and click Start Saving. And best of all, our listeners qualify for a 10% discount off the cloud and SaaS bundle. Just enter CFO Insights Podcast in the Where Did You Hear About Us field. Joe, welcome onto the podcast.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the pod.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, look, I mean, I've known Smedvig for many years, quite a well-known name in London in terms of VC investing, maybe not as well-known as it could be or should be. And you and I met up a few weeks back. We had a chat about some of the exciting things that are going on with Smedvig, and we talked a little bit about finance hires. And we realized it'd be a great topic for the podcast.
Yeah. Shall I tell you a bit about Smedvig and Amida?
Yeah, look, I mean, it'd be great to just to hear like a bit about your background about Smedvig and the type of investing that you know you do at Smedvig.
I'm Joe Knowles. I'm one of three partners at Smedvig Ventures. We're a VC firm based here in London. We've actually been going over 28 years now. Just launched our next fund, which is a 150 million euro fund. And with that, we'll be investing into B2B tech businesses across Europe at the Series A and Series B stage. Now, those Series A, Series B terms are used pretty loosely these days. To us, what that means is we're looking to lead rounds of between $5 and $20 million as a lead investor into companies which are showing consistent signs of early product market fit, which typically happens in the range of between $1 and $10 million of ARR. And the way we invest is we operate what I call a high conviction, high support model, where we make maybe only three or four new investments a year, always as a lead, and then dedicate a lot of time to helping a relatively small family of founders turn that early traction into inspiring success stories. And we're proud to have helped over 100 businesses with that journey now. Personally, I've invested in a few areas, vertical specific operating systems and infrastructure technology, data analytics, tools and platforms, applied AI, and more recently, AI-enabled services.
Fantastic. It's a very diverse range of investments. And I think when you have an investor like that, you know that they're placing three or four investments every year, you kind of feel special. But it's like being kind of part of the family compared to some of the bigger funds where there's just a lot of portfolio companies.
Yeah, I think that's right. I like to think we're pretty selective, and that we have a very close relationship with the founders we end up working with. I aim to be sort of the person they want to pick the phone up to bounce things around and discuss problems.
Yeah, that would be the dream, right? Being the investor that founders really want to talk to and want to kind of use as a sounding board. It's a great model. And when we chatted a few weeks back, one of the topics that just naturally came up was this great sort of conundrum about the first finance hire. So obviously it's startup CFO. We have 960 CFOs and FDs in the group, and a very large number of them would have at some stage in their career have been that first finance hire. And yet that's a tricky role for the finance professional to go in, and there's a lot of things going on, a lot of things to be solved still, but also for the investor directors and the founders. This is a tricky hire, and we thought it'd be a great topic to pick over.
Yeah, agreed. It's one of the questions I always get is, you know, when should a business make its first finance leadership hire? Get asked that time and time again. And I think it's my observation is it's almost always done too late.
Yeah.
Founders typically wait for something to break, for finance to become a sort of drain on their time before they make that leadership hire. And by then it's usually too late. There's already mistakes have been made. Bad habits are in place. And often, to be honest, when we invest at Series A, there's usually not a finance leader in place.
Mm.
And it's usually the first hire we recommend making. And it's usually met with a fair bit of skepticism from founders who don't really know if they need it yet. But time and time again, they'll come back to us and say, that was the best hire we ever made. I wish we'd made it earlier.
Yeah, and that point is really fascinating, right? So one, there is a role of the finance professional as the problem solver, as the person who can sort of come in and maybe the reporting isn't quite right, or the metrics they're focusing on don't seem to be the right ones for the stakes they're going into. And I think often the finance professional is seen as being an accountant or somehow not the kind of person that could pick up the pieces and figure things out. But so often that is the case. But how do you convince the founder that as they go into this kind of like post A round window, that this probably is the moment to bring in a finance lead?
Yeah, well, I'd start by saying my rule of thumb is that by the time a business has about $1 million of ARR, it probably needs a full-time seasoned finance leader. And I mean by that someone who knows what good looks like, who can actually come in and lead and put best practices in place and show the founder what good looks like. And why I use that million as a rule of thumb is at that point, you've probably got 20 plus customers, probably 20 plus employees. And that's where you have sort of enough complexity, enough span of control that you really need to start having consistent data in the business to make strategic rather than tactical decisions. And that's actually the key thing I think founders, one of the misconceptions or misunderstandings about a finance leader is when it's done really well, it's not about putting an accounting system in place. It's not about, you know, putting cost controls in place. It's about creating a culture of data-led decision-making and creating a consistent language in the business that everyone's using, which then means the whole business has much higher quality conversations and makes much better decisions as a result of that sort of data-led conversation.
Yeah, that is really interesting. That's almost like the finance lead as somebody who's bringing a whole new culture into what is a business doing well, but they're bringing a culture about financial responsibility and understanding and focusing on the right data points and really robust decision making, and that leading to some good strategic things ultimately.
Yeah, and I think if that goes well, then the finance leader, whether it's an FD or a CFO, they end up being the sort of go-to person that the CEO relies on as the sort of single source of truth in any senior leadership discussion. And it's typically the CEO and CFO who then become the two people that are needed to make important decisions in the business.
Yeah. And at that window, right, where probably you guys have recently invested and the business is scaling, becoming more complicated, it's becoming bigger. If you found the founder had some fractional support early on, maybe like a part-time CFO, do you find that some of the cultural building blocks are there already? Does that make a difference to you?
Yeah, it's a really good point, actually. And I was speaking to a founder I work closely with on this the other day. Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, from a sort of about $1 million of ARR, I'd say that's when you need a full-time senior experienced finance leader. But actually, I know quite a few founders who would say getting a fractional, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, someone experienced in, actually that should happen from the first pound of revenue. Because exactly as you say, it's about putting building blocks in place and more importantly, avoiding bad habits. Because otherwise, when you bring in that full-time hire, they'll spend the first 12 months, as one founder puts it, unscrewing up all the mess that's happened, you know, that they've inherited.
Yeah, and actually, our members often talk about that first 12 months as kind of building the foundations that essentially the real value add that they will generate. In the end, it comes in the second and third year.
Yeah,
the first year is often like hygiene, just fix all the things that don't really make sense, so that suddenly you can just produce management accounts, and there's a very clear narrative that you've got the right metrics to focus on, and everybody's agreed on what they mean. And that takes time.
Yeah, I mean, I've made investments where 6 months after the investment that we brought a finance leader in, we realized the revenue was 20% lower at the point we invested than we thought it was. Just because the it's all a little bit sketchy. And you know, you accept that as part of early stage investing. But it's I think that the key learnings for me are, one, bring in that finance leader earlier than everyone thinks. Too often we wait till the Series A money comes in. Sometimes that's fine, but it's usually too late. And two, you know, early doors, getting a bit of fractional support, I think, is incredibly helpful.
Yeah, yes.
And it means you get the most out of that full-time hire when they come in.
Yeah, it does mean that whilst you might have incurred a bit more cost out of your seed capital, the minute that you've raised that A round, that person can sort of deploy more effectively, right? You get your ROI a bit later.
And you deploy the Series A capital more effectively.
Yes.
Because you've got better information and inputs into your strategic decisions from day one. You're not sort of flying a little bit blind for the first 12 months whilst you play catch up and putting all the different systems in place and undoing some of the mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody wants to fly blind, that's for sure. Yeah. That is for sure. So like, going back to the role, right? So what does that initial role look like? Like, how do the founders and investors think about, you know, what this person ought to be doing?
Yeah, so I think there's sort of two parts to answer that. One is the slightly more conceptual piece, and then there's some basic building blocks mm-hmm. you'd always expect to see. I guess the sort of philosophically what we're looking for is, yes, the systems and processes that need to go in, but it's much more about, as I mentioned earlier, creating this data-led culture, cost-conscious culture, and creating a consistent financial metrics-based language in the business that leads to higher quality conversations and better decisions. And that's actually what I'm really looking for as an investor when we bring in the finance hire. Obviously, to make that happen, there's a bunch of things that need to go in as well.
Mm.
And if I think about that sort of Series A point as the entry point for a finance leader, what we're looking for is budget and forecasting. That's key, particularly for the board.
Yeah.
Monthly management accounts typically becoming automated and very quick turnaround as part of that process. There's then usually a whole process of company-wide KPIs, which the senior leadership team will drive, but the finance leader then creates the sort of consistent recording and source of truth for all of that. There's then an approvals matrix. That's something that CEOs often really appreciate and sort of hadn't realized how important that was from both a spend management perspective,
yeah,
but also sales, like setting the guardrails about what sales teams can do and can't do and what approvals are needed for discounts, pricing, etc. And as I say, being this sort of single source of truth, we often see, for example, RevOps reporting into the CFO, which again, a lot of founders don't often expect. And then there's some more nuts and bolts things where you look at debt management, compliance.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. Because there's sort of six or seven topics there around whether it's being sort of data driven or having suitable kind of controls around target setting, RevOps, or how sales operates. And I think a lot of experienced FDs and CFOs like feel that they understand those things.
Mm.
And there's a case of, you know, how you deploy that in a business which is still forming. It's probably growing really fast. So there'll be things breaking all the time, new people joining all the time, and the culture is changing. But from the standpoint of the investor, you view this mainly through the lens of the board meeting. So how do the board meetings change? Did you see the CFO start to make these things happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. The board meeting, as a general comment, is where most investors see that. As I sort of said at the start, our model is we work very closely with a small number of companies, which actually means we end up having a lot more interaction, often with the finance director, in between boards as well. So it for us, it's actually a much more broad conversation. But you're right that the board meeting is where most investors sort of see the manifestation of all of this great work. And I think the biggest change we see sort of pre and post Series A is a consistent set of metrics that you're viewing every board meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, before, and I angel invest as well, so I see this yep. transition as an angel investor at an earlier stage, so I see kind of both. But before Series A and before a finance leader comes in, the board packs are often very different. It might be quite qualitative. And as you move to Series A and beyond, you really want to start seeing, okay, everyone at the board is seeing the same information. They know what it is. They trust it. You don't debate what the numbers mean, what they're telling you. You know what that is. And so you end up talking about the implications, how we use it, what we then do with that. That's the biggest change that I see at Series A. And I think another important aspect of that, which usually takes a bit longer, you sort of get your KPIs and your metrics in place first. That takes 6 months or so. And then you move into sort of ROI-based investment decision discussions, where you can actually take a lot of the activities in the business, particularly in tech, which is a little bit harder to quantify, and actually have conversations around what return are we getting on this? Yeah. Why are we putting money into this part of the business? You know, you often read that so tech teams is where VC dollars go to die, because you never really know what's going on, what's built.
It's a great phrase.
Yeah. And actually, you know, I like to start thinking about roadmaps where there's a measurable sort of value impact to every work stream. We can start to track that and think, are we really, is this really where we should be putting our investment? Are we getting a return on it?
Yeah.
So it makes everyone start to think about return on investment, which if you've just taken $10 million, it's surprising how few people think about the day-to-day running of the business in that regard.
And that's not typically something you see in the board meeting, like before a seasoned CFO turns up, right? That's something that begins to turn up in your board agenda once the planning is settled down, once the metrics are kind of agreed on and people all have the same interpretation of them. And then you begin to see almost time made in the board slot for actually there's a big strategic decision coming. And we're going to turn up with some idea about the different ROIs if we do these different things. Yeah. And suddenly you've got like a really high quality strategic conversation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's part of the CFO or FD coming in and putting that in place. It's partly that before that, there just isn't enough information to have those kind of conversations, because you've not really found product market fit. And it's that 0 to 1 million phase. It's a lot more gut feel. It's a lot more the founders just making stuff happen and, you know, being pretty scrappy, frankly, to get stuff done. And that's fine. And that's an incredibly hard and important skill. But it's around that 1 million point, and obviously when you take capital as well, that you start having strategic options, trade-offs. And that's where having this financial literacy in the way the business discusses these things generally leads to much better decisions.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. And I guess, you know, with the long history at Smedvig, you've seen a lot of businesses go through and to exit and to reach some really big outcomes, and you are often still on the board when they're doing their B rounds and their C rounds and things like this. And like, how do you see that role evolving, right? Because the person who's joining when it's doing about $1 million of revenue, they're rolling up their sleeves, they've probably been in a bigger business before, and so they're having to sort of do some of the more grimy work in order to build the position for what comes next. But how do you see their role evolving as they get through, say, the B round and the C round and things like this?
Well, I firstly have to say it's not always the same person makes it all the way through. Often businesses do have to level up the finance leader as they move through those roles. Sometimes they've hired someone up who steps down and you know can grow into those roles. Sometimes they hire someone at the level and hope they can level up. Maybe they don't. And yeah, sometimes you have to keep re-upping the person who you have in that position. But in terms of how the role evolves, firstly, I'd say just the day-to-day execution tends to have exponentially increasing complexity as you grow. You add business units, you add product lines, you add customer segments, you have different pricing models, you might have new geographies and different FX rates, you might have different financing components. So it becomes exponentially more complex. And so the finance leader needs to, you know, first and foremost, be able to put in a team that can cope with that change over time. And once they've done that, it's then about taking themselves out of the weeds and becoming a much more strategic CFO. And what do we mean by that? Well, firstly, I think you notice it in fundraising. So if I think about A and B rounds, it's typically the founder CEO driving those processes, and the finance leader will be an input into part of that process. I think from Series C onwards, you can expect the CFO to be the one driving those processes and actually bringing the founder in as an input. So it creates a massive leverage on the founder's time during fundraising. And you'd also expect the CFO to be driving the financing strategy a bit more. Should we be doing debt? Should we be doing a mixture of debt and equity? All that kind of stuff. The same is true of exit positioning and exit strategy, where you'd expect the CFO to be really thinking about what state the business needs to be in for different types of exits and how to present the business for that. Similarly, working with the board, again, at A and B, they can be a little bit of a sort of co-pilot type situation, whereas actually as you move through the stages, the CFO is much more vocal, much more of a force at the board, and much more driving those board discussions, perhaps alongside a chair. And I guess finally, as someone with the best grasp of the financial drivers of the business, you'd expect to see a CFO, as you move through the rounds, being one of the main inputs into mass expansion, partner strategies, segments, pricing. So some really key strategic decisions in the business.
Yeah. And so there's a bit of succession planning, right? There's a bit of making sure you've got the person that can go the whole way. And if you haven't, then there's something to be done there. Mm-hmm. Presuming that you've got the individual who's got the ability to grow as the lead of the team, because not everybody is comfortable with that. And some people do brilliantly at that, others not so well. But also they're strategic for when their time is freed up by the team, they can deploy that to these much more strategic activities. And then there's a little bit of like partnering with a CEO, right? So that example that you mentioned there, Joe, where you transition towards a C round, a strong CFO can lead that and can book time in with the CEO when that person is needed for certain pitches. But a good deal of the work could sit in the CFO's wheelhouse. There's a bit of give and take there, right? Like those two people need to have developed a great partnership in order for example, the CEO to realize that he or she doesn't need to drive that the way they did, say, the A round and the B round. Is there a role there for the investor sometimes to sort of help the partnership to go on to the next stage?
Yes, I think there is. And it starts with trying to help the CEO, founder CEO, know what good looks like and know what to expect. So of all the senior hires, I mean, if the founder wants us to be, we tend to be involved in all C-level hiring just because we see lots of these different people and to have a view of what good looks like. But probably the finance leader is the one where we can be most helpful because it's often the one the founder doesn't know exactly what good looks like and is a little bit unsure of what they really need there. So part of it is just setting that up and making sure the right kind of person is hired, which usually means hiring up from what the founder might naturally hire for. And it's making them sort of see what good looks like. It's often introducing them to founders who've gone through the same journey, because they always say, yeah, make sure you hire a really good CFO. That's the most important hire I ever made. So there's a little bit of sort of expectation setting that we do that I think is really important. And if you do that, well, actually the rest takes care of itself.
Yeah.
I think personally, I naturally skew to founders who are quite data-led anyway. And so they usually respond well once someone comes in and helps them with that way of thinking.
Yeah.
But occasionally you do get quite big personality clashes in the CEO or CFO. If you've got a founder who's sort of very visionary. Actually, it's an essential and can be a very healthy relationship than having a CEO, CFO who's sort of much more grounded and numbers focused, and you need that tension. But you're right, it can be a tension, and it often needs a bit of massaging to get it to work.
Yeah, it's a great example, right? So that example where the founder's this fantastic visionary, the CFO is grounded and detail orientated. It might be that they have the basis of a fantastic partnership because they are polar opposites in many ways. But the bridge is like, do they get along even when they're not getting along? Do they kind of get along at the end? I think that's something that we hear from the members is that it's important that they make that breakthrough on a personal level.
Yeah,
and actually one of my favorite stories was we were at a breakfast event with. Can say eight CFOs maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and one of the members was explaining what he had done to build this great personal relationship with the founder, and he realized the founder was an early bird, liked to be at his desk early, and so the CFO completely changed his kind of life routine and was like up at like 5:30 in the morning at his desk at 7 a.m. Why? Well, because, you know, me and the founder, we get an hour together where we can do some deep work, we can do some emails, but we can also just have a bit of a conversation when nobody else is in the office.
Yeah.
And that's our time. And that happens 4 days a week. And I thought that was a great story because the CFO had gone to quite a considerable effort in order just to adapt the way that he was working so that he could just sort of unpick the personal relationship bit.
That's a great example, actually. And I mean, whoever that CFO was fair play. They sound like a great...
I think he's a founder there.
That makes sense. Yeah. But I think it's certainly true. If I think about some of the relationships that work really well, the first 6 months, I think, geez, the CFO is working really hard, almost unsustainably hard.
Yeah.
Because almost in that first 6 months, they get the respect and the trust of the founder by showing they're really in their camp. And there's this balance you get of working really hard to get all these systems in place, get the culture right, work to get the board the answers they want, and showing that you're really committed to the business, whilst at the same time actually having to show quite a bit of gravitas and be quite forceful with the founders.
Mm.
But if you get that combo right, which takes quite a bit of work in the first 6 months, you end up, as you say, with this actually very special relationship where there's a huge amount of trust and respect there. And it's one of the reasons I encourage to hire, unlike a lot of other roles, actually, I always advise hiring up, because this also sounds a bit derogatory, but you're looking to the finance lead to be the person to help the business grow up into the next stage, and to some extent help the founder grow up as well. You know, the CFO is almost coming in and saying, for the next phase, this is what good looks like, and I'm going to help you get there, but you're going to have to trust me, and I'm going to, you know, have to be quite forceful to make some of these changes happen, because they're going to be some quite big changes.
Yeah.
So that really does require earning the trust, earning the respect of the founder pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of the CFOs that I talk to have a similar story, and they know that it's hard. They know that the bit when you've got to put the hours in, like a lot of hours in that first 6-9 months, and figure everything out, that one, you get a lot of work done, but you've also earned the respect of the founder or founders.
Mm.
And you're starting to build a platform to be able to challenge them robustly, and for them to respect that rather than feel that their nose is out of joint, or that it was more than they expected, perhaps. Yeah. And that's something that, yeah, you typically need to earn that. You can't push back on those things in month one or month two. You've got to have demonstrated certain things first. I also think it's very interesting that you talk about the degree to which you hire somebody above the immediate needs of the business, because I think a lot of other VCs that I've chatted to, they might talk about supporting the hire of the persona that you've just talked about, Joe. They might talk about that hire at 5 or 10 million of revenue, and you're talking about it at around about one. So I think there are at times sort of almost cultural elements of the VC's outlook as to what they think their businesses ought to be doing that kind of feed into the portfolio. And you can have actually quite different views on who you hire when, almost based on where the check came from for your A-Rep.
Yeah, that's interesting. That might also be a function of the times and where we are in the cycle as well, I think.
Yeah.
You know, as rates have gone where they are, the entire market has become more cost conscious, has become more capital efficiency conscious, which is how it always was. You know, that's the long-term average. When you take money from institutional investors, the business levels up, it has to think about investment, has to think about how it spends money. That's always how it was. And yeah. I guess in the last 5 years or so, where we had this very strange macroeconomic impact of very low interest rates, all of that went out the window for a bit, and there was this sort of grow at all costs, don't worry about capital efficiency because money's very cheap mindset, where perhaps people pushed the finance higher quite a bit because they just thought, oh, it doesn't matter. But I think as we return to sort of more normal, sustainable type of business operation, which is how things always have been, I think people generally speaking see that actually having a decent set of numbers in the business, having a consistent data language, allowing us to make trade-off decisions and discuss return on investment is the right way of running business. So I do think we'll see a sort of convergence towards that thinking in general.
Yeah, I think I've seen that in what some of the members of the group have said, where they feel that their role has returned to business fundamentals, rather maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, it was just hiring and just raising that next round and expanding, like supporting the expansion of the business. And at some point, the fundamentals of the business, be it the margins or the unit economics or, you know, whichever metric you're focused on, that was a little bit forgotten about. It was assumed that would be taken care of maybe a bit later on.
Yeah.
And actually, many of the really strong CFOs are kind of reveling in this moment where
the
market's gone back to fundamentals. You can't always assume you can just raise equity because the market's hot. They're frankly not that hot right now. And you need to demonstrate you've got a great business if you're going to do a B round or a C round right now. So,
well, there have also been some horror stories really around pretty big rounds being raised by, with, you know, very well-known funds into businesses where actually there was no governance and the numbers turned out to be frankly wrong.
Yeah.
So I think there's quite a few people have been burnt in the last part of the cycle. So again, I think there's a definite sort of refocusing on good governance and good corporate structure and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And again, that leans very much into the CFO as the person that you're looking to in the board meeting to like not just to bring you the single source of truth on the numbers, but also some of the governance about certain compliance things the business might have
exactly.
to do, and some of the legal activities are well taken care of. And you know, I think one thing that we've noticed in the group is if we analyze the conversations that we have in our Slack group, there's such a large number of conversations that are things that you would say, well, that's purely commercial, that's not really financial, or that's about HR, or that's about people, or that's about legal activities, T's and C's. And essentially your CFO is also like the chief legal officer.
Yeah.
Quite often the chief people officer in all but job title. And they're having to turn up to the board meeting of a business that's doing well and growing quickly. And so there'll be some things that are breaking because that's the nature of growth, right? But they're having to reflect not just the financial piece, but the legal piece and the human resources piece as well.
And I'd add one more shadow hat to that list, actually, which is board chair. And they might not actually chair the meeting.
Yeah.
But we often look to the CFO to sort of be the person who has puts a lot of the board governance in place, does the InfoSec, does the risk register, make sure the minutes are done properly. Make sure the information is consistent. And actually, I feel it makes my job so much more easy if I trust the CFO enough. I feel they really know what they're doing. You can just relax a lot more versus some of the earlier stage investments where there maybe isn't the CFO. And, you know, you're sort of sitting at a board thinking, you've got to really dig in to make sure we trust these numbers. Not that anyone's sort of not producing numbers deliberately, just because they're not being done in the proper way. And is it really how it should be reported and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
So it definitely makes my job a lot easier when there's a CFO in there who I really trust and who I feel takes their sort of board responsibilities and their company duties very seriously.
Yeah. And that point you make there, Joe, about it being at some level a sort of a quasi chair or their shadow, like one of their shadow hats is to sort of be a sort of chairman type role in the board meeting. Do you see that as being one of the careers that a really seasoned CFO can then sort of go into later on? Like, should some of our members be thinking, hey, look, you know, I could be CFO of a great tech business and maybe I have a big exit 3, 4, 5 years down the line. And then what? Do I go and CFO again? Could I be the chairman of a company? Like, how do you see that transition? Do you think that's a viable path as people go deeper into their careers?
Yes, good question. I certainly think the fractional advisory path is a really interesting one where actually someone with that experience with one day a week can have a huge impact on an early stage business. And you do see ex-CFOs as chairs, particularly, but they typically only if they've been on a, you know, sort of absolutely stellar growth journey, you know, companies like Just Eat, Salesforce. So they've really seen all of that because I think generally, certainly at the sort of A to C stage, when I think about the great chairs I've worked with, it's either someone who's been a CEO and actually grown the business themselves through that phase, or someone with very specific industry knowledge, probably in sales, in the commercial side.
Yeah.
And so I think CFOs can be chairs in much bigger businesses. And if you get CFO of a big PLC, they can and go on to be chair. But at this sort of scale up phase, it's pretty rare, actually, because you really want people who've had a slightly broader experience. The exception being you do see CFO of, you know, star logo cropping up every now and again.
Yeah.
But it's a relatively small pool, actually, within the chair community.
So it's an option if you have a really stellar career and, you know, one of your businesses really gets into hundreds of millions of revenue.
Yeah.
that might well be an option. And one other thing that I'm really keen to circle back on, actually, because I think it's one of the, so some of the things we like to talk about on the podcast are things that are sort of like perhaps not discussed enough, right? Like, mm-hmm. like not quite brought out into the open the way that they could be. And one of the points is around about succession planning, right? So you could invest in a business in the A round and it goes on to do incredibly well. And you hire a great finance person, then it doesn't really matter what job title they get, but you could be a certain number of years in and you realize they're not the CFO for the bit that comes later. And that bit that comes later, it's going to be a great business. And so you need to make a call on it. How does the succession, like, how should that succession planning be managed, right? It's never going to be easy, but I think a lot of members obviously think about these things because like they are those people. They could be there shortly after the A round. They could be the person that comes in for a C or a D. And so kind of joining up the succession piece is obviously key. And I guess you have insights on this.
Yeah. Like, do you mean how should a person in that role think about it? Or do you mean how does the business think about the succession plan?
More about what's best. What would you think is best practice in the ecosystem? Like, based on your experience, that it's just really hard to know when you bring somebody in and it's a small business doing like $1 million revenue. It's really hard to know that they'll be the one in 4 years' time, right? Yeah. So it's not anybody's fault that there's something to manage. That's inevitable. There's something to manage. I think it's more what's the framework for thinking about it, what's the steps that a business goes through, because I think it's just helpful for finance professionals just to sort of know that there probably is a sensible framework for those things.
Yes. So I think the starting point is transparency and openness about these things. The reality, and this almost applies to all of the senior leadership roles, it's very rare that the person that gets you from $1 million of ARR to five is the person that takes you from five to 15 and from 15 to 50 and then all the way to exit. It's just very unusual that one person is the absolute best in class across all of that. And so I think sort of having honest conversations around that is the starting point. And you actually see, you almost see it in candidates actually. Like, you see people who are experts at the one to five phase. They've done it loads of times and their whole career is, I can come in and know what good luck looks like and I'll get you there. And I, you know, I'm personally a big believer in the sort of talent density model, where I'd rather have a smaller number of people paid absolutely top of market, who really know what good looks like on a given phase, but with a clear understanding that they're paid absolute top of market because we're expecting to be top of market. And as soon as they're not the right person for the next phase, which, as you say, is not a criticism, it's just each phase has different needs, that there will be, you know, there'll be a leveling up of that role that needs to happen. So I generally believe in that. All of that being said, there are exceptional people who can grow very fast. You do see people have those stories in their career. You know, there's one CFO I'm on a board with who was CFO from 1 million to, I think, they're about $1 billion of revenue.
Wow,
all the way through.
That's amazing.
And I think there is a degree of path dependency in these roles, actually. I remember looking at a business in Bucharest where, you know, half the team are basically ex-UiPath employees who'd just been on this incredible four-year journey. And I'm sure they were all very good people to start with, but just by virtue of going on that journey, they'd seen so much of how you grow a business that fast that actually I think a load of those kind of people could credibly come in and grow through multiple of these rounds that most of us would take, you know, a 15-year career to see all of those different things. So there is a degree of path dependency there. But to sort of go back to the question, what I'd say is transparency, openness, honesty about the fact that probably in the sort of default position is you're going to need to change the person every few years. And just having an open conversation about that. I think CFO is quite an unusual one, as I said earlier, because I think it's one where I generally recommend hiring up.
Yeah.
So if you're hiring someone at A who's, you know, has done up to D before, then actually it's probably the one role where there's more chance than others of getting all the way through. Because if they can get their hands dirty back at A, you know they're going to make it to D, and they've had time then to think and grow and, you know, maybe be the person that gets at the next stage. And if not, it's because actually you're on such a fast path that you're bringing in a sort of global PLC-ready CFO to be thinking about exit and all that sort of stuff. And the person that's then reporting into them is going to learn so much that it's still worth them staying for that journey, because then the next role, they can be the person to take that on.
Yeah.
So I do think CFO, compared to some of the other senior roles, is one that can have a wider span across the journey. But even then, I think in general, each stage is so different that you typically see people who specialize in each phase.
Yeah. I feel that we see that in the group. I feel that we probably see many more people specializing in a certain window, like the AB window, maybe very occasionally doing the C round, to the people that come in around about the C and go for another 3-4 years, maybe to try to list it or to have a big exit or to get into growth rounds.
And that's what we see. Now, I really look for, when we're hiring, has the person done this specific part of the journey before?
Yeah.
And proven that, and where it's clear that they've done it successfully. Similarly, if you're approaching IPO, you want to hire someone who's done the IPO before. I do think there is a lot of specialism on the different phases. And certainly to make it all the way, it's typically people who've had longer careers and have had the time to accumulate those different experiences. Maybe they've done some fractional work that's given them, you know, maybe they've been later stage, but done some fractional earlier stage. They've built up that breadth of coverage, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. So it feels like, expect it probably to be the case that there's a bit of a tag team with different specialists for different stages. But if you invest enough in the hiring up early and you bring in someone who's had a few years in those later stages, you're increasing your chances of the continuity.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like, the dream is you're getting to deep into growth stage and this person's been in the business like 6, 7, 8 years and like they know everything about the business. And so certain things like fundraising and, you know, diligence and those things just go so smoothly.
Yeah.
When people have been in situ a long time. That's really interesting. So one sort of last question, because we could talk about these things all day, and it's very interesting to sort of get the investor kind of perspective on this conundrum, because I think when you're the CFO yourself, as I was, sometimes it's not as clear to you as it is from perhaps the people that are in your board meeting and observing from the sides. Sometimes you're so busy with everything that's going on, so these things are less clear to you, actually. So it's really interesting to hear your insights. But the one thing that I wanted to ask was, if you think about the CFOs that you've met, you've worked closely with, is there a pattern where you think, there's this one area of skill set that if I could make a sort of general recommendation to somebody that was growing into a CFO role, like the one area of competency to double down on, this is the thing that really impresses your investors?
The capabilities or the competencies that stand out are actually more the soft skills. So there's a hygiene factor, I guess, or a minimum threshold on the financial literacy, competency, putting numbers together, all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
Really, the things that actually stand out as the key traits, I would say, are sort of being personable and having good communication skills. Because I think where great finance operators fail as startup leaders is they can't get buy-in from the business. They sort of get labeled the numbers person, and they just can't create the cultures we talked about earlier, because they can't sort of abstract the key messages from the detail. So that sort of personality communication skill, I think, is key. Another one, which is closely linked to that, is gravitas.
Mm.
We talked about, actually, you have to be quite a strong person to get a CEO to buy into what you're trying to do, to get the whole organization to change its culture. So you need that sort of personality, communication skill, but gravitas as well. And I'd add probably two other things. One is that strategic angle. I think you do see finance operators who are great with the numbers. They put in great processes. There's almost too much information to make decisions.
Yeah.
They haven't quite got that. That sort of strategic mindset to go, okay, these are the things we all need to be talking about, and these are a few enough things that we can make, actually have discussions and make decisions on. So that's a strategic angle. And the final one, which is, I think, as a board member, you care about a lot, is integrity and transparency. Yeah. So people who front load difficult conversations, who, you know, don't worry about sharing bad news, who you just know take their board responsibilities and their company responsibilities very seriously. So that integrity is something that you can tell very early on, and I think puts all the board members at ease.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So when I play that back, the thing that I hear is that actually if you perhaps just naturally, or you've worked on your people skills, you've got those good people skills, you tend to be pretty good at partnering, and not just with the CEO, but through the business generally, which means that you can influence the business and you're more likely to be seen as a strategic leader beyond just a numbers person.
Yeah.
And those things also give you the confidence in the board meeting, for example, to turn up and have to say, well, actually, there's some bad news and we're just going to take you through it and what's happened and why. And that also takes a lot of confidence. It's a lot easier to do that if you would back yourself on your people skills, your kind of presenting and relationship building skills, right? So there's a very interesting kind of combination there. Those are things that we know that FDs and CFOs do spend a good deal of time thinking about and developing, but they're not the easiest things to overtly develop. I think like sometimes people are just naturally great with people, or they're very good at presenting, or very good at like communicating in an organization. And then for other people, that's just a difficult area, and hard to practice, hard to evolve, right? So it's super interesting insight.
I don't want to play down the importance of being good with the basic, finance competences. I'm sort of just taking it as read that someone's going to be, good at that stuff.
They would be present. Yeah, exactly.
It's not normally stand out.
Yeah, yeah. It's it's those things that are given, it's given that you will have those fundamental competencies around controls and reporting and some technical accountancy skills and things like this.
Yeah.
And then what you're seeing, say, in the boardroom or in the funding pitch is the tip of the iceberg. It's the bit where their kind of presentation skills come out and their deep understanding of the business comes out, the fact that they've got a sort of a strategic understanding of what the business is doing and why. It's that kind of, tip of the iceberg thing, not to say that the rest of the iceberg isn't incredibly important, because clearly it is. Joe, this has been like really fun episode to walk through. Look, thank you very much for your time. We've been through like why Smedvig think about hiring up. I think that was absolutely fascinating. That piece where you expect someone who's probably quite seasoned to be rolling up their sleeves and doing some stuff that's fairly grimy the first kind of 12 months. A lot of members would have had that experience and know the value that you get in the end from really putting in those hours. And that's ultimately what earns you that role as the kind of strategic business partner. So it's been super, super interesting. And thank you very much for coming on the podcast and talking about this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You were listening to CFO Insights, brought to you by Startup CFO. If you're a finance professional working in disruptive tech and would like to join our global network, visit our website, startupcfo.tech, to learn more. This podcast was part of our CFO Insights series of discussions. And if you want to learn more about the Startup CFO group, follow us on LinkedIn to learn more about our community and the upcoming events. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.